Reese said, his eyes in constant motion. Just a few more minutes, Reese. Almost there, and we are home free. You know, Haley, you would have made a good team guy. Haley couldn't help but laugh. Senator, we intercepted a call between our subject, James Reese, and the director of the CIA's Special Activities Center, Vic Rodriguez.
Well, what did they say? Thwaite asked, through his Kryptol phone.
Reese said they have proof that this outbreak is a bio-attack, something that infects via an aerosolized spray that cannot be secondarily spread, Sawyer reported.
What kind of idiocy is that? It's in three different cities. People who never came into physical contact are dying of it. That means it is airborne. We are getting cases in Atlanta, for Christ's sake.
I can only report what I've heard.
Where are they going now? The clearly agitated senator asked.
They are bringing their evidence to an office park in Chantilly, Virginia.
Sawyer, they are obviously involved in this plot. They are terrorists themselves. Hell! James Reese was labeled a domestic terrorist by the FBI. He's clearly finishing what he started all those years ago. He wants to bring down the country he blames for the deaths of his family and his SEAL troop. It's your job to prevent that from happening.
He's in a new vehicle, so we don't have him under electronic surveillance, but we know where he's going.
Well, take him out. Save the country.
The office park is a CIA processing facility.
Fucking CIA is involved too, then. Sawyer, you take them out. Save the country. I will not let 200 years of blood, sweat, and tears be destroyed by a domestic terrorist. Kill Reese and the doctor. Help me save the world.
Holy shit, did I hear that right? We get to kill James fucking Reese?
Woody asked.
That's the order, and the doctor, Crimmins confirmed.
Well, fuck me. How illegal is this?
It's a national emergency. Apparently they are involved with the shit in Texas and Colorado.
The virus?
Yeah.
We are going to take down a terrorist SEAL. Oh, shit! Think they'll put me on the cover of Recoil?
Probably, if you pay them enough. You ready to finally be a hero, Worthless?
I'm already a fucking hero, brah. Now I get to add Killer of James Reese to my resume,
Woody said, press-checking the AR from the back of the minivan.
Just be ready, and don't fucking miss.
I don't miss, bro.
I hope not.
It's just up ahead, Reese said, looking in his rearview mirror and noting the dark minivan that changed lanes a few cars back. Are you ready?
I'm ready,
Haley said. Okay, then. Vic has cleared the parking lot except for a few vehicles to make it look occupied. The building is locked down, so no one is coming in or out. Your path to the front door is clear. Haley shifted nervously in her seat.
Seatbelt on? Reese asked. It's on.
We are going to turn in behind them and pull right next to them as they park, Crimmins said.
Fuck yeah, then I pop the door and take them out.
Just remember to take the safety off, Crimmins advised.
Fuck you, Charlie. I know what I'm doing. We did low-vis vehicle interdiction black ops in the stand.
Sure you did. Just remember the safety.
Reese slowed the Cherokee and turned into the office park that operated as the processing center for the CIA's clandestine service, watching closely as the minivan pulled in behind them.
Hold on, Haley.
Just inside the parking area, Reese paused as if he was looking for a place to park. Then he slammed the vehicle in reverse and stepped on the gas.
What the fuck?
Crimmins exclaimed, seeing the target vehicle's reverse lights come on and quickly accelerate toward him. By the time Crimmins's brain registered the fact that the hunters had become the hunted, it was too late. His hand put the van in reverse just as Reese's vehicle made impact with the front bumper. The impact sent Woody, who was already kneeling by the one sliding door, to the floor. Hitting the gas to reverse out, Crimmins felt a second impact and looked at the screen on the dash, seeing that a security barricade had risen behind them. The van was jammed between Reese's vehicle and the barrier. Reaching for the door handle, he abruptly stopped when a black Suburban slid to a stop, cutting off another avenue of escape.
Ignoring Woody in the back of the van yelling about a broken arm, he looked up in time to see a second Suburban skid into place in front of Reese and the doctor, trapping the minivan in a textbook L ambush. He barely registered that the passenger side door of the car had flung open. A female was sprinting from the vehicle, three men in tactical gear falling in with her to escort her to the building in front of them. Hard-looking operators emerged from the SUVs. Crimmins noticed a man in each element held an MK-48 7.62x51 machine gun. The others had M4 carbines with suppressors.
"Maybe I can still push this thing out of the way and get us out of here."
As he put the minivan back in drive and stepped on the gas, he heard the unmistakable sound of a suppressed automatic weapon erupt to his left. Steam exploded from the engine as the open-bolt machine gun tore through the hood and front quarter panel of the vehicle. Crimmins took his foot from the gas pedal and put the van in park. His hands slowly went to the wheel.
"Don't give them an excuse. Woody, put down the AR," he said.
"What the fuck just happened? My fucking arm's broken."
As worthless Woody attempted to prop himself up with his one good arm, the side door opened and he found himself face to face with James Reese. Chapter 68. Russell Senate Office Building, Washington, D.C. Senator Thwaite watched the president's address from the Oval Office in disbelief. He looked so presidential and reassuring, so sure of himself. How could this be? "I want to assure the American people that the end of the crisis is near. We have confirmed through exhaustive international investigations by the world's leading infectious disease specialists that this new virus is indeed a hemorrhagic fever. It originated in Angola but has burned itself out on the African continent. It has done the same here in the United States. We have studied the Angolan virus closely and determined that it will not spread via respiratory pathways, as we saw with COVID-19. Once again, to be perfectly clear, this is not spread like the flu or COVID-19 or the common cold. We had early spikes in Aurora, Colorado and Richardson, Texas, with one-off cases in Atlanta. Since those early spikes, the curve has flattened, naturally, and current infection rates are almost at zero."
"I don't believe it," Thwaite thought.
Even though it was just after noon, the senator held a drink in his quaking, clammy palms. "I can now assure you that this terrible disease has taken the worst of its toll. It has impacted our society and tested us to our core. But we are Americans. We will rise above the fray. The scientific community is working on a vaccine so that if we ever face this enemy again, we will be ready." Thwaite leaned back in his desk chair.
"He's actually turning this into political capital, the son of a bitch."
"There have been reports that the virus was a bioweapon delivered by a foreign enemy. These reports are false. There have also been reports that the virus escaped from a lab here in the United States. Those reports are false."
"What are you up to, Mr. President?"
Thwaite whispered. "I want to address the rumors that there are strategies in place to eradicate viruses on home soil with incendiary bombs. I want to address those rumors honestly. I recently became aware of plans put in place during the Cold War, plans that remained in place until today. Effective immediately, I have signed an executive order placing what are known as eradication measures on hold. A bipartisan commission will submit a report to me within 90 days concerning these legacy policies, with recommendations on how to proceed so that in the face of a future virus, we have other options at our disposal. I commit to you tonight, there will be full transparency in these proceedings. We will harness the power, ingenuity, and brilliance of our scientific community technology sector, and pharmaceutical industry to develop the most effective means of combating emerging hemorrhagic viruses. You have my pledge that you, the people, will be heard, and we will move forward together, stronger and united.
This is unbelievable. He can't do this.
Our thoughts and prayers are with all of those affected by the virus, and with the frontline workers who care for them. We are with you. No effort or expense will be spared to provide you with the resources you need to see this through. May God bless you, and may God continue to bless the United States of America. The video feed switched to a panel of very relieved-looking news contributors. Thwaite continued to stare at the television, not hearing a word. The phone buzzed on his desk. Slowly, he hit the intercom button to connect with his receptionist.
"Isn't this wonderful news, Senator?"
What?
"The president's address. The virus is no longer spreading. We are going to be okay."
Yes, Karen, that's, incredible news.
"Yes, sir. Well, I have a call waiting for you from the FBI. It sounds important."
"The FBI?"
"Yes, Senator. Special Agent Andrew Klein would like to speak with you."
"Please take a message. If he requests a meeting, please schedule it out as far as possible."
Yes, Senator.
Thwaite terminated the connection. Deliberately, he opened a desk drawer and removed his secure phone, looking at it skeptically. Without another viable option, he called Sawyer.
"Did you see it?"
"I did," Sawyer responded. "And I was just about to call you."
"Really?"
"Yes. A source at the FBI has informed me that you and I are both under investigation for the attempted murder of James Reese and Haley Garrett in Virginia, along with a host of other less serious offenses."
"I'm thinking now would be a good time to vacate the premises."
"I'd agree with you."
"Out of the country."
"I'm way ahead of you. Meet me at Signature Aviation at Dulles. If you aren't there in 40 minutes, I leave without you." Thwaite dropped his Kryptol and BlackBerry into the drawer. He took one last look at the portrait of his father and then departed for the airport. Chapter 69. Embassy of Pakistan, Washington, D.C. Hafez Qasem sat at the conference table in the secure room in the basement of the Pakistani embassy in Washington, D.C. Without taking his eyes from the box, he made a slight motion with his right hand. An administrative assistant sliced through the packaging tape and looked to the intelligence chief for further instructions. With another wave, the underling was dismissed, relieved to be out of the presence of the Iranian intelligence chief. It had been labeled a diplomatic pouch, but clearly it was not. The box had been addressed to Qasem personally, which was an anomaly. The Americans knew he operated out of the embassy and even surveilled him occasionally, as they did with all members of the Iranian staff. It was expected for adversaries and even allies to spy on one another. It was all part of the game. Qasem's job was strategy. He was no longer a tactical player. He hadn't been for a long time. The box had the return address of a UPS store in Annapolis. He observed it for any suspicious signs that should have been warnings to some of his brethren in Hezbollah and the Quds Force, when mailing death had become a popular tactic of the Israeli intelligence services. It wasn't leaking. It didn't smell. There were no protruding wires. It had been swiped for chemical residue, and the Pakistani embassy had the dogs sniff it for explosives. A company provided the service off embassy grounds so as not to offend with the filthy animals. All those tests had returned negative. It had also been X-rayed. The electromagnetic radiation had revealed the contents. Qasem knew what it was. He needed to confirm who it was. Qasem was confident it would not explode. It contained a message meant for the lead Iranian spy in the United States. Qasem stood and pushed away the cardboard to reveal the next layer. Whatever was inside had been wrapped in aluminum foil and plastic wrap. It reminded Qasem of a wrapped present the Americans were so fond of giving one another on the bastardization of the prophet Jesus' day of birth, when Isa ibn Maryam was sent with the Injil to foretell the coming of the prophet Muhammad. Rumin Allah, the Spirit of God. The Iranian spymaster carefully sliced through the foil with a jambiya, the traditional curved blade of his ancestors. Nizari Ismailis. Carefully he parted the shiny plastic and aluminum barrier to reveal the tan plastic top of a cooler. He worked his fingers down the front and lifted the rubber latches, continuing to inspect for wires just in case something had been missed in its prior security inspection. It was also never beyond the realm of possibility that someone in the ISI, Pakistan's intelligence service, wanted him dead. One could not be too careful in the world of espionage. All clear. Then, slowly, he opened the lid. Looking up at him was the severed head of Ali Reza Ansari. Instead of horror, Qasem studied the upturned eyes of the man he'd passed the Marburg virus to just weeks earlier. Dried ice had been packed around the head to keep it fresh, so that Qasem would have no trouble with identification. There was something peculiar about the mouth. A piece of plastic was protruding from between purple lips. Qasem pinched it between his thumb and forefinger, extracting a Ziploc bag with a single piece of paper inside. He turned it over. It read simply, September 10th. They know. Hafez Qasem reached for the phone on the table to his right.
Ready the plane. I will be returning to Iran tonight.
Chapter 70. Rhys sat in the back of the smallest version of Mercedes's venerable Sprinter van. This one was painted white with a floral business moniker on each side. If someone Googled the business to find the website and called the listed number, they would hear a recording in which a pleasant woman's voice would explain that they were busy arranging flowers and would return the call as soon as possible. The call, of course, would never be returned. Inside, it was anything but a flower delivery van. The walls, floor, and ceiling were lined in black, sound-dampening material, and there was no access to the driver's compartment. Shackles were attached to the floor and wall, a bench seat was built into the right side, and one chair was bolted into the floor.
Okay, he's departing the embassy on foot, no variation from his daily profile other than the time and the fact that his phone is still inside.
Good copy, came Ox's voice over the encrypted radio.
You get that, White Knight?
White Knight copies, Rhys said into his radio.
Just need to know if he's going home or to the airport.
He's taking Route 3, a voice informed them. The voice belonged to the UAV operator whose ISR platform had electronically tagged their target. They had been tailing Qasem for 6 days and had identified 3 routes he used to walk from his office in the Pakistani embassy to the house the Iranians rented for him through their Pakistani surrogates in the North Cleveland Park area of the city. Hitting him at the embassy was a no-go, and security at the rented apartment was run through the Pakistanis. He varied his daily routine, but one could only take so many routes home. There would always be an identifiable choke point. Choke points presented a problem when dealing with a trained intelligence operative. They knew the choke points as well as those who hunted them. That's why Rhys wasn't going to hit him at a choke point. Qasem noted that pedestrians were on the streets as they emerged from self-imposed isolation and returned to businesses in the aftermath of the virus scare. Some 5,872 Americans had died from the virus, most of those in Aurora and Richardson, with a few isolated cases in Atlanta. Ali, having to use the remote dispersal device, had hurt their numbers. Releasing the virus in high-traffic areas before hitting the hospitals had been a stroke of genius. It had been Ali's idea, and reinforced to the scientific community that medical staffs were getting it from patients just by breathing the same air. Another 257 people had died in clashes with the military and law enforcement. In Qassem's estimation, American confidence in government, elected politicians, and the military had hit rock bottom. But unfortunately, there were glimmers of recovery. The new president was leading the country out of the pits of despair and working with Congress on an economic stimulus package focused on Colorado and Texas. Americans were a resilient lot. President Christensen had flown immediately to Texas following his address to the nation. In a video that had since gone viral, a camera crew caught Marine One making an unscheduled landing on University Park Field near the hospital in Richardson that had first reported the virus. A body bag had been removed from a refrigerated truck. It was on a gurney.